Welcome to 30 Minutes in the New Testament, live from Tuscarora, Pennsylvania. It's not a town, though, is it?
No, it's a retreat center, but well, it'll work. Know. Everybody knows what you're talking about.
I don't live here.
Mount Bethel.
It's a town. It's kind of like a town. It's a little town. It's like its own little town.
It is. It feels like that.
Yeah, it does.
Mm-hmm.
But we're doing a special episode because we're live from the camp, and so we're taking a break from Acts to do what?
We're looking at John 8 today. So, yeah, we've been here all week. We've had a good time. And Dan and I have been able to teach for this week. We've been able to preach and had a great time getting to know the students here. And so we're taking some time now to record today's podcast. And, yeah, we're looking at, I'm sure, what is, for many listening to the podcast today, a very famous, well-known passage out of John chapter 8, sometimes referred to as the woman caught in adultery. And it begins in verse 2, early in the morning, he came again to the temple. All the people came to him, and he sat down and taught them. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery, and placing her in the midst, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman has been caught in the act of adultery." Well, I suppose we should probably just stop there and point out a couple of things about this scenario that from the get-go are not adding up well for these scribes and Pharisees.
Yeah.
So first of all, where's the dude?
Yeah, if you're caught in the act, there was like, so he must, he's either, like, he's really quick. He's
not away
to be,
real
he's
fast.
He's not to be messed with. I don't know, but it's there. It seems like there could be possibly like a little good old boys club, as they say, a little sexism happening here.
Yeah.
Because, if you're caught in the act, then there's two people in this, mm-hmm. involved in this, but they only nabbed one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they, it
so
seems
then, so
like,
they're after some justice, but like not really justice.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like they're picking on this woman, almost as if it's like, it almost seems like it's kind of set up. I mean, really. You know, they point out her sin. Nothing about the guy. We're only left to speculate as to why. Based on the track record of the scribes and Pharisees in the past, wouldn't put it past them at all to basically ignore the sins of the man and point out just the sin of the woman. But then, of course, they point out in verse 5, "Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. So what do you say?" This they said to test him, that they might have some charge to bring against him. Now, is it true, Dan, that in the law there was, in fact, this statement that a woman who had committed adultery could, in fact, be stoned to death? I mean, is this accurate?
But adultery in general, yeah.
Yeah. So they're not lying about that. I mean, they are acknowledging something that is, in fact, true. And yet there is something that is that should be taken into account about this. This law and the strict strict application of it to stone someone who had committed this sin was almost never done. I mean, we don't have really any recorded instances from this time period at all of somebody being stoned for this in Jerusalem. This is not something that happened. And so there was many other ways that they chose to deal with this problem. But it was technically true. I mean, the law demanded death.
Well, there's something that you have to understand about the Jewish law. Like, this is not something that's like carved in stone in the Ten Commandments. So this is law given to Israel. This is civil law. So this is how they would deal with certain people that have committed certain sins or in some cases certain crimes. And the law is placed, the law serves not as like an absolute requirement, but actually as how far you may go. And so like there are capital offenses that could technically could be applied. So if you murder somebody, the most grievous punishment that you are allowed to give to someone is death. But not all things are like that. So you might have heard of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, right? You ever heard of that statement?
Mm-hmm.
That is sure. Not what that statement is, a limiting statement, not a demanding statement. So it doesn't say that that it's not saying that you have to. So if I cut off your hand, it does not say that. Does not mean that you have to go and demand that my hand be cut off. It means that you can't demand that my head be cut off. Mm-hmm. So a hand for, like an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, means that like basically that the punishment has to fit the crime. It doesn't have to. It's just not allowed to exceed it.
Yeah, you shouldn't go beyond it. It was meant to limit the possibility of what we naturally want to do. I mean, I've got, you know, three boys, and my three boys are the punishment for whatever crime one brother commits against the other is never perfectly equal. I mean, if one brother comes up and slaps the other in the face, then the other one wants to punch him in the face. I mean, you know, so, and of course, that's how, you know, things escalate, and, you know, hitting in the face eventually leads to murder and that sort of thing in the broader society. Hopefully not in my home.
Well, what was,
Lord willing.
Well, what was prone to happen is, like, back in the day, it's like, maybe some guy kills your brother. So then you go and kill his brother. And then he comes. Then he comes back and kills your whole family.
Yeah.
And then you go back and wipe out like his. And like then you have like this chaotic thing. So what the law was supposed to do is say like this is as far as like the punishment can go. In the case of adultery for this woman, then the extent of the law does say that like yeah you could stone her, but it's not like they say he demands that you don't have to. Mm-hmm. But the person that who is offended in the thing. So basically, another thing you don't see is like, I don't know where this girl's husband is, but this is actually up to him. Like that's how this works. Like he could say like, I'm so hurt, I'm so betrayed. But the reason that this hardly ever happened is because very rarely did even like did a husband in those cases say like, yeah, stoner. Like that didn't usually happen. But it's not just simply up to these dudes, like, let's do it. Like, that's why it didn't usually happen. Again, it is allowed, but not required.
Yeah, and very unusual by this time, especially, and really any time since. It has not been something that is part of Jewish life.
And can we just say this, too? Like, that I'll admit that seems super harsh. Mm-hmm. I mean, just in my ear holes. It's super harsh to be like, all right, what's going to happen is like adultery is a serious thing. That's not no big deal. But like, whoa, like you're going to kill somebody? Like that seems rough. The point of that is that the wages of sin is death. And the law of God always is pointing you towards like what it deserves. Like, so like, what does it deserve? It deserves death. Even within the society, it didn't usually receive death. It is sin, and since we all die, the ultimate penalty for it is death. Like, the penalty for all our sin is death. Like, we're all going to die. Now, Christ has defeated death, and so we're not going to ultimately die because he died that death for us. But if you're thinking, wow, so someone messes up in that way, which is like a big way, but like still like that, like stoned to death, like that seems barbaric and rough. I agree, it does. But it's pointing you to something greater, which is all sin is worthy of the judgment of God and death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's ultimately pointing to the holiness of God, that God is, and why we desperately need a Savior.
Right. Well, don't be deceived.
Every one of us.
Someone's going to die for this sin. It's just not going to be her.
And of course, then we find out in verse 6, the motives of the men bringing her to him are not, they're not interested in justice. They're not interested in making sure that, you know, society is served well by making sure the women know they can't be having affairs with whoever they want. No, it's very clear, verse 6.
It is a trap.
Yeah, this they said to test him. It's a trap, you know, that they might have some charge to bring against him. Now, you see this over and over and over again with the Pharisees and the scribes all throughout Jesus' ministry. They always try and set traps for him because they can't stand him. They're very jealous of his ministry, the way that he's taking away their crowd, their influence, and they're constantly trying to find a way to stop him. And so they do this stuff. And man, every time, I mean, every single time, it does not work out well for them.
Well, what's crazy is what they're trying to do, because what they're trying to do is use the law. They're like, Moses says that we should like we can stone someone like this. And if Jesus is like, go ahead, what they're going to do is like, they're going, and they have the crowd. Like, so you'll see,
they got a mob.
Like, they got a mob going. They're like, they're ready to do it. And they're like, yeah, get, like, there, should we authorize it? Like, get Jesus to authorize it. Then we'll be able to spread the rumor, like, this guy's out, like, telling people to stone women. Like, we would never do that. Like, we're for you guys. We love you. We wouldn't, like, it's bad, but we would never, like, do that.
Yeah, so ironically, they're trying to make Jesus look more harsh and strict and mean than them. Or, on the other hand, make him look like he's Mr. If he lets her go or doesn't condemn the sin, you know, or doesn't deal with it, then the thought is, well, and this is an accusation he dealt with all the time, is that he doesn't care about the law, that he doesn't care about obedience, that he does, you know, that Jesus, he was accused of being a glutton and a drunkard when he was here. Not that he was either of those things, but that's what they said he was, because he hung out with tax collectors and sinners all the time. And so it got him accused of either being too gracious. And in this case, it's like, well, he's either too strict or too gracious. So it seems like the perfect trap. Seems like we've got him. What's he going to do to get out of it? Well, you know, Jesus is the Son of God, and he's smarter than them. So it says, middle of verse 6, Jesus bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground. So what is it, Dan? What did he write on the ground? We are going to declare to you today, we have figured out exactly what he wrote on the ground. What is it?
I think he was playing tic-tac-toe with,
that's like, right,
with the Apostle Peter.
And they were doing the O's and he was X's?
Yeah,
no.
He's like, I couldn't care less what you guys are saying. No, we don't know. I think probably he was writing out the Decalogue. He was writing out the Ten Commandments based on what happens next. I think he, like, they're bringing up the law, they're bringing up Moses. I think it's likely that he's writing out the Ten Commandments, but don't know for sure.
Yeah. I've tended to err on that side too. One can have any number of guesses about it. For whatever reason,
let me tell you another reason why. Like, when it talks about it, when Moses gets the Ten Commandments, you guys remember the story? And it says, like, that they were written with the finger of God.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, in tablets of stone. He wrote them with his finger. Like, his finger's a chisel. And he, like, carves these Ten Commandments into the tablets of stone. And when it talks about, like, Jesus is God, like, he, if God has a finger, it belongs to Jesus. That's how it works. Like, the only finger God has is Jesus' finger. So if it's written with the finger of Jesus, and then they hear it, it says that Jesus goes and he starts writing in the ground with his finger. I don't know. Like it just seems like this all works. Like, oh yeah, you wrote this law with your finger before, and you're like back that same. And I think it's like pretty cool if the finger that wrote into the tablets of stone for Moses that they bring up, they're like, Moses says this, and he's like, dude, I wrote that junk. Like, I carved that into stone with this finger. I'm doing it right now. Number one, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Number two, like, he's just like reliving that. I'm not saying I can definitively prove that, but it's too awesome to not be true.
Yeah, I love right? the thought of it. I mean, yeah. That's right.
Like, let's just go there together. Yeah. Let's believe it together.
And initially, I mean, it does seem that they're not they. I do think that it probably is something like that. Something that
it's exactly
whatever it
like
is,
that.
It's convicting them. It's convicting them, and yet initially there's still a little fight in them, you know. Like, so he's writing on the ground, and it says in verse 7, and as they continued to ask him, so they were still. You get this sense of, like, you picture this woman kneeling before Jesus or right next to Jesus. They've thrown her down in front of him. There's a large circle, a large mob of men surrounding him, and as he's bending down, they're still like, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? You have to do something. You can't just let women like this get away with sinning. You can't let sin not be atoned for in some way, Jesus. You know, they're challenging him. And so he stands up and then just
As he finishes the 10th commandment.
Says to them, let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her.
Like, you guys know that. Like, you guys have, like, totally heard, like, cast first stone. Right? He's gonna cast like that whole thing. Yeah, that's where it comes from. And I mean, it's a little used up. Like, it's got a lot of run. That line. It's got a lot of play. But it's pretty good.
It's still
powerful. I mean, it's pretty good in the context. Like, all right, like, assuming, like, if you wrote the Ten Commandments, like, and they're there, they are, like, do not lie, do not steal, honor your father and mother, don't covet. And he's like, all right, dudes.
Well,
here's a list, check it twice, and then throw that stone. Like, if you're feeling froggy, leap. And
I think he did say that, actually, no in one's... the Greek. If you're feeling froggy, leap, yo.
Yeah. Yeah.
But here's the thing. I mean, this statement, the reason that it has so much staying power and has been repeated so much, I think is significant because, especially in our age, we're living in a time in social media, on Instagram and Twitter and, you know, whatever you happen to be on, where everyone is looking to throw a stone at everyone.
Yeah.
I mean, like, social media mobs are responsible for multiple people losing their careers, losing, you know, influence, getting death threats. I mean, there's whole books written about people that tweeted out something stupid or something even offensive that deserved criticism, but then pretty soon the mob comes at this person and the mob is filled to the brim with self-righteousness, just dripping with self-righteousness, condemning the sins of this person or that person.
Yeah, this is like 100% the first like epic virtue signal. It's like these dudes like dragging this woman out, like, everyone take a look.
Yeah.
I found her. Look what I've exposed. I've given you this to be outraged about.
So the application here for anybody, I mean, it's not just to the Pharisees back then, but it's to me, is to remember this statement myself. When I'm tempted to look at my neighbor and be like, oh my goodness, what, this is ridiculous. I cannot believe this. To be like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, I got plenty of things that are worthy of hellfire myself. I got plenty of reasons that I deserve to be stoned. Today, as a 20-year-long Christian, today I do. So I better be real careful before I start picking up stones to go after this celebrity or that person with this sort of, you know, height of self-righteousness. Like, I better be real careful. The only one actually who could legitimately pick up a stone here?
Doesn't
do it. And that's Jesus. If there was one that could have done it, it was him. Yeah. And he would have been just in doing it.
Yeah, he's saving his strength to pick up a cross instead. He's got things to do.
And so he says, and once more, it says verse 8, and once more he bent down and wrote on the ground. This is when he finished the 10th commandment, Daniel. But when they heard it, they went away one by one. And I love this little detail. Beginning with the older ones, and Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Do you think there's any significance to the fact that the older ones began to leave first?
Yeah, because here's the thing. Like, these people right here, like, they think they're sinners. But, like, Andrew knows he's a sinner because he's, like, straight up lived, like, more time, more sin. Like, that's how this works. Like, so the older you are, the more you're like, yeah, like that. I have my sin stop. My sin pile is not is ever increased. Like, so you got some, like, old dudes that have lived a while and they're like, I busted those commandments straight up lots. And, you know, and then, like, and it goes down. Like, maybe some of the younger people, like, some of the teenagers were like,
I think I'm still pretty good.
I'm pretty good.
Maybe I can pick up a pebble.
Like,
I still want a stoner.
Like, they're actually going over the commandments, like, maybe. Oh, shoot, I guess I broke that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's what it is. No, the older you are, the more... It's not this. Like, you trust me, you're just as big a sinner as me. But the longer you live, the more undeniable your sinfulness is. Like, there's no, you can't get away with, like, fronting, that you're not a sinner if you've lived a long time.
And it's not that your sin, it's not that like your sin looks worse or something as you get older. It's just that as you get older, you do, I think you, like the Apostle Paul in one of his last writings that we know of, it's interesting, you can see sort of the progression of his life, but by the end of it, he refers to himself as the chief of sinners, the worst of all sinners. And so you would think, you know, after time, that the thinking is that like he becomes better and better and is like, man, you know, by the end of it, you could see him writing, you could picture him writing the letter like, this is the Apostle Paul, the one who is absolutely crushing it now.
Yeah.
But in fact, like he's utterly more aware of the fact like, no, I'm even more aware of the mess that I thought wasn't there when I was younger. It is, you know.
Well, I think that you do like sin less when you get older, but that's just because you're tired. It's just there's some sins that like take like a little bit of energy, and you're like, I don't have it in me anymore. It's just too hard. Like it's hard to sin a whole bunch when you're just like, I'm just staying in bed.
Yeah, can I just take a nap? Yeah. So eventually, starting with the older folks and then moving to the younger, it's just him and this woman. So, I mean, just try to, one of the great things about narrative is that you can place yourself sort of in the midst of the story. I mean, whether you're a female or not, picture being this woman who just a few seconds ago was in dreadful fear of losing her life. And for that matter, wasn't sure that Jesus might go along with them. Just don't know. And now, she's just alone with Jesus. Everybody's left. He has he has thrown water on that fire and put it out. There's just smoke now and nothing left. And Jesus stood up and said to her, verse 10, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" And she said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more." Very, very, very important thing to point out about this last statement from Jesus. All of Christianity hinges on the proper order of that last statement. If you reverse it, you lose all of Christianity. The faith is ruined, rotten. And frankly, the church has done it way too much. The church has often preached this: go and sin no more, and then neither will I condemn you. That is not what Jesus says. Jesus says, first, a declaration: you are not condemned. You are forgiven. You were an adulterer. You are not now. You're forgiven. You're clean. In light of that, go and sin no more.
Yeah, I think you have to look at the sin itself too. That part of what he's doing is, I mean, this is like scarlet letter kind of stuff. I mean, she just dragged out in public and in front of everybody. And that is going to be like who she is now, right? Like, and what Jesus does is like he says, "You're not condemned," and he frees her to go and not be that mistake, not be that sin. Like, you don't have to go be that. That doesn't have to be you. Like, I've forgiven you in such a way that you're free to, like, you don't have to be that person. Like, you don't have to be marked like that forever. Like, I've forgiven that. You're not condemned with that. Like, you should go and be something else. Like, this is obviously destructive. This experience was obviously, like, I mean, can you think of a more terrifying experience? Go and be more. Like, you can go and just be something different. But, like, this isn't going to mark you forever. I think a lot of times we certain sins can become like your identity. Like, I mean, like, this, you're a murderer. You're, I mean, you're an adulterer. It's not just like these names have like these sins have names attached to them. So like adultery is a thing, but an adulterer is a person, is a title. And a murderer is a title. Like murder is a thing, murderer is a title. Lying is a thing, liar is a title. And what Jesus does in his forgiveness is like says you're not that. Like that's not your name. Like, so like you're not adulterer, liar, murderer, like because I've said you're not. Like I've said you're not condemned. I've said that you're free to go and be something else. So I think that's legit. And I think that because it's hard, but sometimes it is hard. Like, man, I don't know, man. You do things that you're ashamed of, and you think like that's who I am right now. Like, I can't move past that. Like, it's just. I mean, like, imagine something like that too. That's like public, like that. Some dude, like, I mean, if somebody gets arrested for murder, convicted of murder, and they get thrown into jail, like, are they? How can what you need something powerful to shake that title of murderer? Like, are you ever going to be more than that? You ever going to be anything other than that? And Jesus is like, yeah, you are. You can go and not be that. Mm-hmm. Like, you can go and not be your sin. Like, you can be something different.
It again relates to what has become the unofficial theme of all of our talks this week, which is you are who God says you are. That wasn't, you know, we hadn't like mapped this out or planned this out, but that has just been the recurring theme over and over and over again. And, you know, I want to point out, and I don't know how much time we have left, but we don't have much time here. We're almost to 30 minutes, but I just want to point out that there will be times where things don't wrap up as clean as this. Like, there will be times in your life where you may be condemned by others for something you've done. You may indeed have people that don't accept the title that Jesus gives you and will remind you of your sin. And they're not going to let it go. They're going to bring it up. That could very well happen. That does happen a lot. And it's important to have this preached to yourself all the time. That's why it's so important to be a part of a church or to be in a place where every Sunday you're getting the goods, where someone can stand up and tell you, no, it's true again. Remember, you're not that. I know, like, out in the world, they're all telling you that's who you are, but this is where it's real. This is the real word. You'll forget that. Your sinful nature wants to tell you, and the devil's all too eager to remind you of all the ways that you don't measure up to the identity that Jesus says you are. So you need to have somebody preaching that into your earballs all the time. You are who he says he is. You're not condemned. You are clean. You are pure. You are forgiven. And yes, I did mean to say earballs. So
that's it. And that's it. That's the end of it.
All right. 30 minutes is the New Testament.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.